of the Buddha's description of his experience, the free mind. And there are a few other words that are used in this area to describe the Buddha describing his experience, and kind of preface this talk the way I did the last one, where, you know, this isn't about figuring it out or following it or getting it at all, because, you know, we're talking about the mind of the Buddha here. And maybe the hope, or my hope with this is, you know, my own reflection, exploration around these words, this topic has kind of created maybe little hints or little openings to a possibility, allowing the mind to maybe kind of drop in and see something somewhat differently, opening to a flavor of non-attachment, what that means, the freedom of that. And so in my own experience, this has been kind of a reflection, as I said the other day, kind of like Chintamaya Panya, and then seeing how does that land? How does that reflection land? Not by trying to get it or figure it out or follow it, but just the words that are offered, the reflections. We might get a little taste of something, a possibility, even a possibility that our minds hadn't opened to before, hadn't conceived of, hadn't imagined, because of our imaginings, our conceivings being so conditioned by our own lives, our own histories. And so in a way here, we're exploring the possibility of conceivings, imaginings that might support moving to the ending of conceivings and imaginings. So at the beginning of the sutta that we explored yesterday, there was a phrase, I'll reread this. Whatsoever is seen, heard, cognized, sensed, cognized, attained, sought after, and pondered over by the mind, that I have fully understood. All that is fully known to the Tathagata, but the Tathagata has not taken a stand on it. Not taken a stand on what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized. Not taken a stand on what is fully understood. Not taken a stand on what is fully known. Let me think about taking a stand, even just that phrase, taking a stand in our normal language often means having a viewpoint, having a perspective that we're kind of coming from and planting our stake in the ground. This is what I believe. This is what is true. And so this not taking a stand, perhaps connected to that. And in fact, at the very end of the sutta, we'll see if I get to the last bit of the sutta, it does point to this notion of not picking up concepts as true or false, or creating a view about them. Maybe I'll just go ahead and read that part too. Why wait? Whatsoever is seen, heard, sensed, or clung to is esteemed as truth by other folk. Amidst those who are entrenched in their own views, being such, that word we talked about briefly a couple of times, such, none other than this, just this, I hold none as true or false. This barb, which I beheld well in advance, whereon mankind is hooked, impaled. This barb being the next sentence he says, I know, I see, 'tis verily so, in quotes. That being the barb that we are hooked on. No such clinging for the Tathagata. And so this is kind of, to me, this points back to this first bit of not taking a stand, not even on what is fully known, fully understood, not taking a stand on it, not creating a view about it, not, what does that mean? I'm not completely sure, but, you know, a flavor that comes into my mind as I reflect on that, you know, what it means to not take a view or not take a stand or not say this is true, this is truth. I know and I'm seeing this is what is true. That statement often connects to the content or the concept rather than being a statement or connection about what is the truth of the moment. In a way, perhaps we could say that the truth of a moment is what is arising in this moment, what is ceasing in this moment. I'm not taking a stand on anything in that flow and not creating a concept about this is the way it is and creating a truth about that. The truth of a thought is that it is arising, rather than the truth, like taking a stand on the content of that thought. It's just some reflections on this taking a stand. Not taking a stand based on craving, on view, on conceiving about an object, attaching to things, creating something to stand on. That's another piece that resonates here in a way for me, this notion of taking a stand on what is known, seen. The way our minds typically take a stand is to land on something, maybe with a view, but also maybe just with the sense of there's a thing there, like we talked about the other day, the conceiving of a scene, a conceiving of a thing worth seeing. So the way our minds typically take a stand, this kind of contrast between what the Buddha describes about this mind, the mind of freedom, not taking a stand. Not taking a stand on what is seen, heard, sensed, cognized. Not taking a stand on what is fully understood. Not taking a stand on what is fully known. Because what is fully known, fully understood is direct experience, and there's nothing to stand on there. the way we typically take a stand is we think of like needing to hold on to something or have something to stand on. But the way our minds do that is to create something upon which to stand. And so it's all in the mind, this standing on something, this sense of landing somewhere or having something solid or stable to be with. It's all made up in the mind. And this is really what we explored in the last days. The landing on something, the standing on something, and the thing that we land on, all manufactured. There's a sutta that speaks about experience. I have a copy of this. I don't have it here. I'll have to do it kind of from memory. It's something like the eye and forms are changing, impermanent, unreliable. Eye contact and eye consciousness based on that impermanent, unreliable eye and forms, of course, of nature, are changing, unreliable, tottering. The entire set of experience that happens is this unreliable, tottering experience. And then on top of that, on top of the eye consciousness, the consciousness and the contact already tottering, already changing, this no object there, just changing, already changing even as it's met with awareness. Our thoughts, our views, our perceptions are built on that. Being built on that, how can they also not be tottering? So any standing that we think we're doing is very unstable. That instability. Our mind is trying to latch on to something for stability, and the very thing we're trying to latch on to for stability is inherently unstable. It is a project destined for suffering. So not taking a stand, an alternative that doesn't occur to most of us until perhaps we hear something like this. This notion of the tottering eye informs impermanent changing, the contact, the consciousness tottering based on that, the feelings, the perceptions, the thought tottering based on that. It's like you're building this tower. And what the base is already tottering, so it gets more and more unstable the further up it is built. The instability, the unreliability of all experience pointed to here. And this reminds me of, this came up in one of the groups, just a memory of another sutta, a couple other suttas actually pulling together here. One that I mentioned the other day speaks of our tendency, our kind of the ordinary person, ordinary people have this tendency to kind of put their investment in a sense of existence or non-existence. Really flip sides of a coin here. existence or non-existence, and the Buddha pointing to when one sees that things are arising, this arising of experience, the idea of non-existence is not relevant, because there's this seeing of the arising, seeing, so there's so not nothing. And for one who sees the ending of experience as it actually is, the idea of something existing also doesn't make sense. It's not something. It's not nothing. It's not something. And the Buddha goes on to point out that all that's happening is conditioned phenomena, this impermanent, unstable, the tottering, essentially. He points to the nature of experience as just conditioned, and that all that's happening is unreliable experience arising and unreliable experience ceasing. That's all that's happening. And so as for taking a stand in this unreliable world, the Buddha was asked at one point how he crossed over the flood, how he crossed over the river of greed, aversion, and delusion. And he said, by neither tarrying nor hurrying, I crossed over the flood. When I tarried, I sank. When I hurried, I got swept away. By neither tarrying nor hurrying, I crossed the flood. And to me, this again kind of points to that not standing. I mean, the visual image of it is not standing still. It is neither tarrying nor hurrying. It is this moment with this experience, this arising experience, and then the mutation of that into the next experience. Not a thing, just transmuting experience. Crossing the flood, seeing essentially this image of the Buddha neither tarrying nor hurrying. You know, the question that comes up for me is like, you know, why tarry when all there is impermanent, unreliable experience? Why tarry with that? Why hurry when all there is to come is impermanent, unreliable experience? Just this. Bhikkhu Bodhi translated this phrase of not taking a stand as the Tathagata is not subservient to that. So we look at this again. Whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, reached, sought after, examined by the mind, that I have directly known. It has been known by the Tathagata, but the Tathagata does not become subservient to it. And again, does not become subservient to the seen, the heard, the sensed, the cognized, nor the knowing and the understanding. Not like, it's an interesting image for me. It's like in Nyanaponika's translation, not taking a stand on, it's like the sense of being on top of, in control or something, being in control of experience, standing on it. And what Bhikkhu Bodhi points out is kind of a flip side, is that thinking we are in control, we are actually being controlled by the forces of greed, aversion, and delusion, subservient to those forces. The Buddha not subservient to craving, clinging. Not being subservient to conceiving. Conceiving of a visible thing apart from sight, conceiving of an unseen, conceiving of a thing worth seeing, conceiving of a seer. We do live our lives in some way subservient to that process of identification. We don't think of it that way, but have you had the experience of feeling like, you know, I need this, I have to do this, and it's like you're feeling like you're just being manipulated by habits and patterns? That's that feeling of being subservient, ruled by our habits of mind, by greed, aversion, and delusion. The other word in that first sentence is such. The word to me is to kind of feel into again that that word evokes. The Tathagata being such like in regard to all phenomena seen, heard, and sensed and cognized, is such. The word such, translating Upali Tadi, basically the word means something like this simple word. What if we replace that? The Tathagata being this in regard to all phenomena seen, heard, sensed, and cognized is this. Nothing other than this. Just this. That's evocative for me of the nothing other than the seen, heard, sensed, and cognized. This is kind of back to the Bahiya Sutta. In the seen is only the seen, and the heard is only the heard, and the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only the cognized. No cognizer, no thing cognized, just the process of cognition. The process of cognition, cognizing and no difference between cognizing and knowing what is cognized. It's all the same thing. Kind of evokes that a sense of such evokes that for me, that sense of just this. Nothing else. Just processes. Creating and receiving experience. The same processes that receive the experience are the creators of experience. Nothing else. Such. Just this. This is the kind of the view or the perspective that we're encouraged to have with our mindfulness practice. Just this. And then we see where the mind adds stuff, brings stuff in. Tries to stand. Suffers from trying to stand. Trying to stabilize. Paradoxically, the word such, to me this is a little koan almost. The word such is often translated as stable. So Bhikkhu Bodhi translates that sentence that I just read about the Tathagata being such like in regard to all phenomena seen, heard, sensed, and cognized is such. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as being ever stable amongst those these seen, heard, sensed, cognized. The Tathagata is a stable one. And to me, that creates a one, very different feelings in a way between those two, the way they read, the way they land. And the reflection about this, though, is, again, to kind of like hold these two together. What does it mean to be stable when experience is tottering, changing? There's nothing stable to be on. What does it mean to be stable there? And the proposal is that the non-clinging, not trying to create stability, is the stability. This brings back almost that sense of taking a stand, not taking a stand. The Tathagata does not take a stand, and yet they are stable. Put those two words right next to each other, and they are in that first sentence. Not taking a stand, the Tathagata is stable. By not taking a stand, by not landing on reifying, conceiving, thing-making, I-making and thing-making, by not doing that, that is described as stability. It's like, this is a completely different kind of stability than I'm familiar with. And so it's like just holding that notion, the possibility of kind of stability. It talks a little bit about that sense of like the slippery nature of experience. Just touching into that really tottering, changing instability. What might it mean? Not clinging with that instability. And every now and then the taste of what it means to not hold on or try to hold on in there. The taste of an ease. That's a different kind of stability. Not the kind of stability we think about, but the mind that is not wavering, the mind not agitated, the mind not tottering. Undisturbed, the mind undisturbed, maybe another way to frame it, the mind undisturbed by impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. Not that it's like, I mean, that this undisturbed, I like that word undisturbed, because it's like, it's neither rejecting it or, you know, trying to hold on in there. Not trying to create something or make it nothing. Undisturbed doesn't mean we have to agree or like it. That has been kind of an eye-opening thing in my own practice, that place in the middle where the mind is not clinging or not identifying. One teacher frames it as, you know, this non-clinging, non-craving, allowing acceptance of what is not about either liking, agreeing, or disagreeing. The mind thinks in those terms, agree, disagree, exist, non-exist. This middle place of undisturbed doesn't have to agree or disagree. Disagree and agree, not relevant. Just experience, phenomenon, happening. There's one other word that comes in often with in connection to such, or comes in connection to the freed mind, the mind of freedom, and that is the Pali atamayata, translated sometimes as non-fashioning, sometimes as non-identification. And one place in the suttas, a couple places it comes up in the suttas to give a sense of what it means. One place it mentions that with respect to meditation, we shouldn't make an object out of a meditative state. You know, that we should, that the non-fashioning or non-identification with meditative states is supportive in moving towards freedom. The Buddha teaches non-fashioning, non-identification with respect to concentration. The Buddha reminds his monks, of this. Don't make a thing out of that. Don't make an eye about one who experienced that, or recognize that happens. Another place this comes up is in it's a long teaching, and I won't go through the whole teaching, but it's a series of stages of how the practice can unfold. By relying on something, we can abandon something else. By relying on this, abandon that. By relying on wholesome states, we can abandon unwholesome states. And it goes through a number of steps like this. And at the kind of the end of this series of by relying on this, abandon that, it says, by relying on atamayata, by relying on non-fashioning, by relying on non-identification, two different translations, one non-fashioning from Tanisaro Bhikkhu, non-identification from Bhikkhu Bodhi. By relying on non-fashioning, non-identification, one abandons equanimity. So even pointing to how we can cling to equanimity, we can make an I out of being the one who is equanimous. We can make a thing out of equanimity. To me, this atamayata, the word, it points to both sides. You know, the conceiving, the word of conceiving is really looking many times at the sense of I that's made. We talked about conceiving a seer, conceiving a visible thing apart from sight. That phrase brings together the processes where they kind of happen together, the conceiving of a one who sees and a thing seen happen together. But the word conceiving is usually pointing to the sense of self, the identification. And then other words like papancha, that word of the objectification, the reification, that's pointing to the side of the process that's more the thing making. So these two sides of the process happen together, but useful perhaps to have different words for the different aspects of the process. Sometimes when we're opening to our experience, it's very clear there's a sense of I, me happening. So we're seeing the conceiving, we're seeing the sense of self arising, the I making, the my making. Other times there's more of a sense of seeing how the mind is reaching out onto an object and landing there and holding it, the papancha at work to reify the experience. Simultaneously, a sense of one who knows that is happening, but sometimes what we experience more is the side of the clingings, the object that's out there. We feel the suffering of that kind of holding on to an object. And so a different kind of pointing to this, that side of the experience that can be seen and known. So these two words referring to different aspects of the same process at work, conceiving and papancha. Atamayata, the word, basically the word means something like, the literal word means something like not made of that. That has the same resonance for me when I hear that literal translation, has the same resonance for me as such. Not made of that, not the experience, just the experience, no making in it at all. No making, just transmuting. No thinging, no I-ing, no my-ing. And so to me, this word atamayata kind of points to the simultaneity of those two processes. No making, it's no making anything. There's no making. The last sentence from the suttas I'll bring in. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya. That persevering sage, having conquered the deceiver, you could say having conquered delusion, having conquered ignorance, the persevering sage having conquered Mara, having overcome death, has reached the end of births, a wise one, a knower of the world, is such. A sage, unfashioned in regard to all phenomena. Conquering ignorance, one is such, just this unfashioned in regard to all phenomena. No conceiving, no making, no making, no fashioning, no fashioning of ideas, of concepts, of the fashioning being the not the fact that there is an arising, but the standing with that arising. So there were a couple of questions about wisdom, which seems an appropriate reflection to follow those thoughts. Basically, not quite sure. You know, I've been hearing wisdom and find I don't really understand what it means. Would you provide a definition of wisdom? So, I offered a perspective on this in the first talk I gave. So perhaps one thing you could explore is re-listening to that talk with that question in mind and seeing if there's a new understanding that comes, holding that question and listening to the offering there. The wisdom, I mean, sometimes we might think of, and the question, one of the questions was, is wisdom insight? Well, there is that form of wisdom where wisdom allows the mind to be released from suffering. I said that's the job description of wisdom, understanding suffering and releasing from suffering. And description of what we could say the job description of wisdom is. Wisdom is a mental formation. It's not some special other thing outside of the five aggregates. It is right within this process of mind and body that it is cultivated, that it develops, that it grows. Another function of wisdom, actually, the person who asked the other question, could you give a definition in a second question, is, oh, here's what my understanding of wisdom is. It discerns what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. That's a great definition of wisdom, actually. Wisdom understands what leads to suffering. Wisdom understands what leads to release from suffering, the kind of the definition of, you know, wholesome and unwholesome. So that's a great definition of wisdom. And that wisdom, that understanding, has different levels. So we've been talking about, you know, been talking about these reflections that I just offered today, you know, the reflections on the mind of freedom. It's that these words are offered, the description of what the mind of freedom is offered in the teachings as a support to help us understand there's a whole radically new way to look at things. And so we can use that in our minds. And so we hear it. One level of wisdom is that we hear this information. We take it in, and it's kind of like, then we start massaging it, thinking about it, reflecting on it, maybe even touching into something new, you know, something that feels like, wow, that maybe makes some sense. So we need some kind of wisdom coming from the outside, some teachings or some orientation or a pointing. Like, look at your experience as human experience and see what happens for you. The teachings of wisdom in the case of the Buddha are not just statements of fact. We could say they're not really statements of fact. They're more descriptions of processes at work. And the encouragement is to come and see. See these processes at work. That is where the freedom lies, is seeing the processes at work. And so the wisdom starts with a kind of statements of what we call fact, statements of, you know, the view, wise view, uses words to state a perspective. But that is not the ultimate, like, I mean, we don't just like memorize that. It doesn't do much for us if we just memorize it and think about it that way. Although I think it's pretty potent. It's pretty potent wisdom. It's pretty potent wisdom. Even if we just thought those thoughts all day and all night, it might have an effect on us. You know, if that's all we did with the wisdom was just think about it, it might filter in there because it's really potent wisdom. But the Buddha does ask us to engage and to start looking at experience. So part of the wisdom the Buddha teaches is look at your mind. This is our practice. We look at the mind, we look at experience, we see, and then we begin to recognize, because perhaps the descriptions that the Buddha has offered, they are reflections of what happens in direct experience. So we can see that. But it's so subtle. What the Buddha describes is so subtle that often we don't see it unless it's pointed out. You know, I don't think, if I hadn't heard these teachings, I would still be really in that self-hatred and anger. It would not be pretty. So the hearing of the possibility, you know, just that very first thing that I got, the book, the first book that a friend sent me, Everyday Zen by Joko Beck, you know, somewhere in that book, I got the idea of notice what's happening with your anger rather than just buying into it. Just be aware that anger is happening while anger is happening. It's like there's wisdom in that statement. I had no idea why it would be useful, why it would be helpful. But, you know, fortunately, in some ways, I felt like I had nothing else to try, so might as well try this. And pretty quickly, within a couple of months, it became very clear to me why it was helpful. The mind saw the suffering nature of the anger. That itself was an aha. You know, it's like, whoa, I thought it was making the other person miserable, but boy, it's sure making me miserable. That was an insight. That's where the wisdom begins to penetrate. That's where there's more of that recognition of wisdom operating. When wisdom operates in our, when the mental formation, when the volitional formation of wisdom develops, it starts to act to free the mind. And that's what I began seeing happening around anger. The mind seeing the pain of it, and beginning to let it go. I had not got much else in the way of the teachings of the Buddha beside that one thing. See what happens if you pay attention to your anger instead of just following it. So right there, that's a statement of wisdom that's pointing to an action that we can take that's different than we usually do. And so counterintuitive. So that, you know, it's like all of the wisdom that the Buddha, much of the wisdom that the Buddha offers is not at all what we think. It like turns what we think on our head. What we think of as true. And like, of course, this is the way things are. When we start to look at our experience, it's like, wow, that was just completely misunderstood. The mind misunderstanding. So we would not, I mean, the Buddha kind of had a mind that could figure this out without being told, without it having been pointed out to him. And it said that is incredibly rare, that we are very fortunate to be living in a time where there is a being that has discovered that and we have the transmission of that knowledge. It came to us. Because most of us need help. Most of us need to hear these teachings, hear the wisdom that just at the point of hearing the wisdom in words, there is wisdom there. That's not wisdom. Those words bring in to the mind the beginnings of wisdom that then we begin to act on, engage with, it deepens into the reflective kind of wisdom that then is experienced when the wisdom is strengthened, is experienced as the release from suffering. So when we experience the release, the experience of the of wisdom. Somebody asked me this on one retreat. What are the symptoms of wisdom? Like, how can I know it's happening? Some of you were at that retreat. what are the symptoms of wisdom? And I kind of thought through this and reflected, well, one thing that might happen is kind of a sense of space that we might have around experience, that we can see experience, but we're not caught by it. So that might be a flavor that we know wisdom is working, wisdom at work there, when we can see something happening and we're not caught by it. Another flavor of wisdom might be noticing, and this is the most kind of direct way, in a way, of seeing seeing wisdom, is when the mind kind of sees itself headed to some kind of suffering, some kind of habit or pattern. And I describe this with the anger at times. I don't know that I've done it on this retreat, but there was a moment of seeing the mind kind of headed into the thought about the person that I was angry with, and recognizing, in the split second, not knowing there wasn't anger in that moment, but that the mind was wanting to get angry. So seeing the intention towards anger. The mind saw the thought arise, saw there wasn't anger present, but saw the mind kind of wanting to get angry. And in that seeing of the wanting to get angry, immediately there was this understanding. And this was wisdom at work. It was so clearly not something I did, because I would not have known how to do this. The mind, seeing that movement towards anger, knew that way lies suffering. And wisdom just said, I don't think so. Just let it go. That's a very direct, sometimes when we see the mind intending to go towards suffering, and then we can see the wisdom say, not going to go there. And it definitely feels like I'm not saying, oh yeah, I'm not going to go there. I'm not doing that. It has nothing to do with me. It has a clear sense that there is a function of something that understands that way lies suffering. And that's not a good place for the mind to go. That's a way that we can experience wisdom in the moment, the third level of wisdom, bhavanamaya panya, the wisdom of insight. So that is the wisdom of insight is a form of wisdom, but it's not the only form of wisdom. And then there's another way that wisdom works that's kind of more almost it's subtle. It might not be obvious to us that wisdom is working. But when there is peace, when the mind is not in reactivity, and we can be in concentration. In concentration, there can be a suppression of reactivity that may not have full wisdom in it. It can be kind of just the focused mind has set aside the reactivity. But there is an experience of just the mind in a state of peace, reactivity not arising, that is also wisdom at work. Wisdom simply not picking up what would lead to suffering, not even going to that intention. This is connected to a word that's found in the teaching of transcendent dependent origination, which describes the conditions that lead us from suffering to freedom. The word dispassion . The mind just not engaged by greed, aversion, and delusion. It's not interested in that. we can kind of maybe get a flavor or a taste of this by reflecting on, you know, the way our minds like let go of things that are old or, you know, things from our past that used to have such a hold on us, but now, you know, your very first, I don't know, this might have a hook for some of you, I don't know, but the very first person you fell in love with, you know, for me, I was five years old and fell in love with my neighbor. And, you know, there was that sense of, you know, wanting, and the devastation when he told me he couldn't sit next to me on the bus, you know, all of that, you know, that, you know, where is that devastation now? You know, it's just the mind doesn't, it's not relevant anymore. It was a five-year-old's mind doing that. The mind has transcended that. It's moved past that. So the mind does that. Wisdom does that with greed, aversion, and delusion. Just doesn't pick things up. Non-fashioning wisdom, not picking up the maker of things, the maker of self, the maker of measurement. Not picking up lust, greed, aversion, and delusion. So that's wisdom at work too, but it can be so subtle that we don't like recognize it. So subtle. We can just kind of land there and it's like, oh yeah, this feels pretty good. But we may not consciously recognize wisdom's at work here. At one point, so this is probably enough at the end here. Sayadaw said, get to know wisdom at work. This is a function of the mind, so get to know what it does. You know, I used to think wisdom is something like really big or grand or something, and it's like, well, actually it happens. Like there's a functioning with wisdom. And so that's a great instruction, especially for those of you who ask the question. Look in your experience. How does wisdom work? At first, all I could do with that is just like really confusing. It's like, wisdom at work? What does that even mean? But I played with it for the retreat. I think it was like a, you know, it was either a 4-week or a 6-week retreat. I played with this and when the mind was kind of at ease, when there wasn't a kind of clinging or suffering, I just said to myself, well, there's wisdom at work here somehow. I don't know what wisdom it is. I don't know if it's wisdom about this or that, but there's some kind of wisdom happening here. And that's where I started. I'm just kind of acknowledging when there was not reactivity, this is wisdom at work. And then beginning to see, actually, the mind had been seeing wisdom at work right from that, probably that very first moment I started noticing, oh, this is anger, this hurts. You know, that was wisdom at work. And so the reflection began to open my mind to how much wisdom had been growing and accumulating throughout the whole length of my practice. So it's not something to do, as Sayadaw says, nothing I say is anything to do, but it's just kind of dropping that in. You know, it's possible to notice wisdom at work and then just let the mind do with that thought or that intention what it does. My mind picked it up, played with it for a few weeks, and learned some things about wisdom at work. So, no time for questions in the hall today, but may these words, this offering be of service to your practice And if they are not of service to your practice, just let them go. Forget about them. You're welcome to completely forget everything I've said today. Some of it might stick, some of it might not. May it be of service to the support of your happiness and freedom and the happiness and freedom of all beings everywhere. May all beings know the deepest happiness of peace. Thank you all. See you tomorrow.